Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
So, tonight, this is going to be in belated tribute to Judith Houtman. Or I could say it's going to be the delayed Valentine's Day studying, because there are two stories about marriages, and they're really focused on the women in the marriage.
It's open.
Come on in.
I think Michelle closed it.
Michelle. Every person that came in tonight shut the door all the way.
I didn't.
Well, hold up.
I did not.
Oh, okay. I take it back.
I'm very careful. I shut the screen, which is all glass now.
Just around without revealing. I was so excited I had a picture. Okay.
Good evening, all.
You're all set.
I'm all set down there.
So as I was saying, tonight is a belated tribute to Judith Houtman, because we have two Talmudic stories about marriages and men and women.
Okay.
And both stories, here's the introduction. Oh, and we have a new feature tonight too, which is for each story I've given you two different versions. One is called Admiel Cosman, who is the man, or I assume it's a man, who wrote the papers that I got these from. Okay. So I give tribute to him. And the other is the Sansino. And I have yet a third version in English that I'm going to read, so you can follow either story. So the question for both of these stories is, are these love stories? That's what I want you to think of. One of them is famous. The other one is not. They're both interesting. And what we'll do is read all the way through it, and then we'll go back and talk about it. So, and they're both from the tractate Ketubot, which is marriage contracts. Not as we know that it necessarily means that's what it'll be about. Okay. So the first is the famous story of Rabbi Akiva and his wife. Rabbi Akiva was the shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua, one of the wealthy residents of Jerusalem. The daughter of Ben Kalba Savua, note that she has no name, saw that he was humble and refined. And you have different English, I know, for that. So that's interesting too. She said to him, "If I betroth myself to you, will you go to the study hall to learn Torah?" I'm saying words that are interpolated in between that you don't necessarily have. He said to her, yes. She became betrothed to him privately and sent him off to study. Her father heard this and became angry. He removed her from his house, that's it, I would have said he expelled her, and took a vow prohibiting her from benefiting from his property. In simple words, he cut her out of the will.
Where would she go?
Rabbi Akiva went and sat for 12 years in the study hall. When he came back to the house, he brought 12,000 students with him, and as he approached, he heard an old man saying to his wife, "For how long will you lead the life of a widow of a living man, living alone while your husband is in another place?" She said to him, "If he would listen to me, he would sit and study for another 12 years." When Rabbi Akiva heard this, he said, "I have permission to do this." He went back and sat for another 12 years in the study hall. When he came back, he brought 24,000 students with him. His wife heard him and went out toward him to greet him. Her neighbor said, "Borrow some clothes and wear them, as your current apparel is not appropriate to meet an important person." She said to them, and this is a quote from Proverbs, "A righteous man understands the life of his beast." When she came to him, she fell on her face and kissed his feet. His attendants pushed her away, as they did not know who she was, and he said to them, "Leave her alone, as my Torah knowledge and yours is actually hers." Ending. In the meantime, her father heard that a great man came to the town. He said, "I will go to him. Maybe he will nullify my vow, and I will be able to support my daughter." He came to him to ask about nullifying his vow, and Rabbi Akiva said to him, "Did you vow, thinking that this Akiva would become a great man?" He said to him, "If I had believed he would know even one chapter or one halacha, I would not have been so harsh." He said to him, "I am he." Then Kalba Savua fell on his face and kissed his feet and gave him half his money. Has anyone heard the story before?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a very famous story that's told. In fact, this story, there's more than one variation of it. There's a version in the Midrash, and there's a version in each of the Talmuds. It's a very popular story.
See, I heard the story of him seeing the water on the stone.
Yeah, that's the prelude to this, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the story goes that he's a shepherd, and he's 40 years old when he goes to study. And one day he's watching the sheep, and he sees a rock, and it's been carved out by the water dripping on it. And he says, if water can make rock an impression on the rock, then surely Torah can make an impression on me. All right, so the historicity of this, is this a true story or not? So all the different narratives of this, for those who like comic books, the origin story, make no mention of Rabbi Akiva's mate being the daughter of Ben Kalba Savua. By the way, Ben Kalba Savua means it means the son of an unsatisfied dog. Okay, it's a strange name. None of the stories mention that she is the daughter of a wealthy man. And historically, this is 40 years after the destruction of the temple, so it's kind of likely that he really would have been wealthy. That she initiated the relationship with Akiva, that Akiva was Ben Kalba Savua's shepherd, and even that he was a shepherd by profession. In other stories, Rabbi Akiva is depicted as a hewer of wood, a wood chopper, which was kind of the lowest of the low jobs. But all the stories do agree that he started out ignorant and unlettered, and he rose to greatness by studying Torah. So most scholars agree that this is a literary story and not a historical story. Okay, so the key question that will open our discussion is this. Is this a story of romantic love? Is this a love, falling in love story that is common in all societies and all literatures? or perhaps is this characterization anachronistic? It's not true to its time, and it's inserting that idea into a literature that really didn't know or have love stories of that kind of a society. So there's three possibilities, unless somebody wants to opine here on what they think about this.
Well, I'm just not sure why those are mutually exclusive.
Why what are not mutually exclusive?
It being a love story or it being not of its time.
Because if it's a literary work, then it's hewing to literary modes of its day. And the thought is that these were not common stories in ancient Israel when they were composed.
But it could still be.
But it still could be.
It could still be a love story and fit that category, is what I'm saying. It could be.
Yes, it could. It could.
I'm still not convinced that it is a love story, actually.
Okay. So.
Wait a minute, she locks herself away for 24 years waiting for her man to return from the sea.
But he's already 40 years old when she's betrothed to him.
Right, so he's 64 now.
Well. One would think that a 40-year-old man who is a wood chopper is probably not going to inspire
not
the
great
heart
marriage,
of
marriage material.
You know, well,
but she saw that he was good and noble,
right?
But
and humble.
Okay, but is a woman looking for a man to be good and noble, or would you, or put it another way, would you expect her to say? He was handsome, he was charming, he swept her off his feet.
She was probably looking for somebody who could support her.
But to say it was probably a provider is what you're looking for.
She's the daughter of a wealthy man.
She's the daughter of a
wealthy man. Still.
Yeah, but clearly his position, at least at the time that she met him, was basically that he was on the lowest rung of the ladder. So
right.
in terms of looking for somebody to support her, that probably wasn't what she would aspire to.
And if I understand the way the society worked back then, if she was old enough to come to that kind of deal, she would have already been married. I mean, they married, you know, by our standards.
Well, we don't know, it doesn't say how old she was, so she could have been young and innocent and...
12.
Just, I don't know, taken with Akiva.
Because 12 is usually when they married in that day.
By the way, the context of this is it's set among a number of stories about women who wait 24 years or 12 years, and some of them, when the husband comes back finally, they're infertile because they've waited too long. I don't know what the larger meaning of that is, but that is some of the context. But notice another thing, though. The text says only that they were betrothed. It doesn't say they got married.
Yeah.
That's correct.
But isn't this kind of a duplicate of your ultra-Orthodox as of today? From day one, they know who the male or female is going to marry.
No,
because she is attracted to him because of his qualities. It's not an arranged marriage. And that's what it is in the Haredi world. So, okay, so this is good.
I have another question before you go on. When you read your version, which was different from the ones here, you indicated that when he returned and the father went up to him, he wanted to be released from his vow so that he could profit from something, but his vow was that his daughter won't be able to use the money.
No. Correct.
He wanted to be released from that vow.
He wanted to be able to give his daughter the money.
Because he said it in anger and he regretted it, but he couldn't go back on his vow. So he was looking for a way to get out of that vow. Which is also curious because where was the daughter living for 12 years? And then
that's what I'd like to know.
On the front lawn.
The story was she was living in the barn, actually.
Yeah.
And by the way, the daughter's name is usually given as Rachel. So we can refer to her that way. Okay. But that's interesting. So this is a good discussion. It's not as simple as it first appears. And is this a love story? So I have four possibilities of what it could be.
Okay.
And the first is a story of romantic love. The question then is, if that's so, why doesn't it say so? It only says that she thinks he is humble and refined, in my version. Right? Is that love?
Maybe that's enough.
Maybe. I always have to do the disclaimer of, I'm not telling you there's an answer to any of these questions. I will lead you where I think it goes, but I'm just posing this as a question. In another version, this would make it romantic. It says, in winter they slept on straw in the barn, and he had to pick the straw from her hair. He said to her, if I could, I would give you golden Jerusalem. And that's a love story kind of thing. They wake up in the barn, they're covered with straw.
So
it's romantic.
That's before she sent him away, though.
Probably.
The whole point of
before.
This story is the fact that it is her giving his blessing. Giving him her blessing to go study.
And she's the one who initiates,
right.
not
right.
him.
Right.
Which leads me to my second one. So if it's not romantic love, maybe it's about love of Torah. Maybe it's about spiritual love. Maybe she sees in him something spiritual that she wants him to develop. Not because necessarily she loves him, but because she thinks this is his path in life.
Yeah, the other question I have is, who paid for his education? It was not free back then.
Maybe he took a night job at Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay, morning.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just...
But, so the question...
They leave these things out.
No, they do, and I think they do for a reason.
Yeah.
Although I do think when you look into it more deeply, as we will see, something's come out of that you hadn't necessarily thought of.
Because at first I thought she was going to support him while he went to the academy.
And in a way she did. I mean, she was working. Right, she had to make a living because the father wasn't supporting her.
Right.
But it raises the question of, if if it's a case of, I'll call it spiritual love, then why couldn't she have just said to her father, Dad, I know this boy, he's really got something, why don't you sponsor him to be a Torah scholar? Okay. Number three, she's ashamed of him because he's so ignorant. And that's the motivation in the story for her to send him away. And number four is she wants to mollify her father because her father's obviously unhappy with him. So again, she sends him away to get educated, to make him more attractive to her father.
It started out as teenage
rebellion. Well, except that that's a condition right at the beginning.
Yes.
The betrothal, the betrothal is contingent upon you going to the study hall. Kind of, sort of.
Yes. Yeah. No, you're completely right. But it still goes back to the motivation of why is that so?
Right.
But if she just wanted him to not be ignorant, 12 years seems like an awfully long time for him to go away to come back as an educated man. I mean, he was very educated, he was very knowledgeable, but that seems like an awfully long time for him to be gone. And then before she even speaks to him again, she's basically saying, you know what, he should go away for another 12 years, which is...
Well, and of course, as a literary device, 12 years could just mean a long time.
Yeah.
Just
no,
like
I understand
he
that.
Probably didn't come back with 12,000 students either.
Well, I was wondering where they all bedded down, and then he comes back with 24,000 students.
Yes. It
must be a very large town.
As those days, the age were shorter than they are today. There's a theory a meteorite hit the Earth, and our orbit is now farther away from the sun. Like your patriots, Abraham, Isaac, they lived over 100 years old.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but I don't think that applies, at least in Talmudic times.
If this was done in order to please the father's the one who got really upset. The
yes.
father did not disinherit her until after she was betrothed and she was sending him away.
But how do you become?
Study.
So maybe this is like Indiana Jones where he would say she chose poorly.
And the other question is, how do you become secretly betrothed?
I can see that.
I can see that.
Betrothal
was...
That's not how it was done, you're right.
It was a big deal. And it was a contract, and it was a...
And it was effectively a state of marriage.
And it was
except you didn't live together.
You know, publicly.
And she didn't.
So this other suitors wouldn't waste their time.
I'm trying to find a way to send it over to you. Subtly.
Okay. Let's talk about the structure of the story. So the structure, I think, it starts off low, goes high, goes back to low again. The tension comes from the bond of the couple, and the efforts to sever the bond. So there are positive parts of this story and negative parts of this story. The father expels her, the old man bemoans her, he's successful, etc. There's waves of opposition that occur in this story. And here's what I'm suggesting. There are four oppositions to the marriage. I'll call it the marriage. Right? First there's her father, then there's the old man, then there's the neighbor, then there's the attendants. And we'll talk about each one in turn. And I want to say that each one of those types of opposition stands for a different view of what marriage is. And that will help clarify the nature of the relationship between Rachel and Akiva. So let's start off with the father, first case. He opposed Akiva. Why? Because he was ignorant? Because he was poor? Because he was a bad risk? We don't know. But why then did he expel his daughter? Was it to weaken her resolve? Was it, and here's an interesting part, right? She's a rich girl and he's a poor boy. So how do we know what his, look at the from the father's point of view, how do we know what his intentions are Maybe he wants to marry her because he wants her dowry. He wants her father's money.
Wants to marry up.
So the father sees this relationship as a relationship about class and money. It's a poor boy trying to get into a rich family, which is not unreasonable. Then there's his reaction at the end of the story, right? He wants to annul his vow. Now, he doesn't come to beg forgiveness or even to say he's sorry or express any kind of regret. All he does at the end is he prostrates himself and he gives money. He says, half my money, right? And that's showing consistency that he's the same man. Once again, his concern is status and money. So that's how the father is looking at the relationship.
Which is not, I mean, marriages were economic transactions back then. More often.
Now too.
but they were even, back then they were, the romantic marriage was the exception rather than the rule.
Right.
That's true.
Whereas I would venture to say for the most part now, although there are economic transactions now, they're not the norm. They're the exception. Back then they were the norm.
No, and it's true. So that's view of marriage one, marrying for money, to put it in very simple terms. Next comes the old man, right? To refresh yourself, the old man is sitting there and saying, how long will you lead the life of the widow, the living widowhood, as he calls it? Now, this old man is traditionally thought of, who are all old men thought of as in the Talmud?
The rabbis?
Elijah. He is, first of all, why? Because he's a conduit. If not for him, Akiva would not have gone off for the second period of 12 years. He's the one that brings that to the fore. And he has a view that Rachel is a living widowhood, which implies that if you're in a marriage, the marriage must be shared, or it's not a good marriage. And there is a text to back this up. If you turn the page from the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 3. And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in a ward, and provided them with sustenance, but went not unto them. So they were shut up unto the day of their death in widowhood with their husband alive. So that's what this is a reference to, a living widowhood. So view of marriage number two, marriage is a shared experience. And then therefore this is not really a marriage. Number three is the neighbor who says, borrow clothes and wear them. And by the way, she says, in response, a righteous man understands the life of his beast. She's the beast, meaning she looks horrible. She's dressed in rags and so on. So these are neighbors, presumably, I think it does say they're women, are they not? Her neighbors say.
Her neighbors told her.
It doesn't say.
Yeah, you're right, it doesn't say. So they're presumed to be women. And this is review of marriage three that assumes a woman that is desirous of maintaining a good relationship with her husband must take pains to look good for him. But Rachel and Akiva's bond is of a higher nature, because when they both met, they were both poor people. I mean, slovenly. Well, she probably wasn't. I take that back.
She
was rich.
Yeah, she probably would have been pretty and dressed well, certainly.
But the neighbors can't see that, right? To the neighbors, it's all superficial. It's what they look like, what she looks like. So that's view of marriage number three. Finally, the last case is Akiva's attendance. When she tries to approach him in public when he comes back to town, and the attendants push her away. And they actually physically push her, right? And the thing is, the attendants also don't see the bond between the two people, between Rachel and Akiva. From the attendants' point of view, they see a raggedy woman trying to get close to the exalted rabbi. it's almost a reverse of the beginning of the story when it's the beautiful daughter with the poor shepherd. And that's when you have the big denouement, the big reveal of the story, when Akiva says, he rips away this false view of her, and he says to them, everything that you have is from her. And it's very dramatic. And the point is, the attendants, who are physical, who are pushers, not in the bad sense, they can't see the spiritual world that unites these two people. So the tension in the story, I think, is between the inner and outer worlds. We see the inner world from the start. We see that she appreciates his characteristics, which are not dramatic characteristics, humble and refined. It's not something that you would, you know, notice about a person just from looking at them. But she sees it, she sees the inner world and has this connection. And that's also a reason why there's a lot of references in this story to clothing, because clothing represents the outer world, the physical world. So now we turn to the original question, is this a romantic love story? And the answer seems to be no. The answer seems to be it's a spiritual story, because the thing that's missing from a romantic love story is an intense sexual attraction between two people. And you don't have that here. We should be suspicious of Akiva. He's marrying a rich man's daughter. He neglects her to promote himself, to become a great person. And when the attendants push her aside, we fear that Akiva will pretend he doesn't know her. Because after all, he doesn't need anything from her at this point. He's set. But then he does that one line when he reveals that his study, in effect, is his gift to her. That it's fulfilling her wish. No, because that was her wish. He should study. And now he's coming back when he could have ignored her and saying, look, I did what you asked me to do, and it's for you. And now we do see that he is a truly righteous person. So the relationship is one of seeing the qualities in the other, not of a romantic love. Romantic love means mutual dependency, but they are both independent people. She's living alone, he's living alone, they're both pursuing different things. Real love in this case is spiritual love, it's love of Torah. It's not the emotions, another thing from the love story, it's not their emotions that drive the story, it's the hidden spiritual side that drives the story. Rachel is really the pinnacle of the story. She outranks Akiva and the students, even though she doesn't study, but she makes study available to him. So even though he's a great Torah scholar, the story is saying she's higher on the scale because she enables the Torah study.
She more than enabled it. I mean, she drove it.
She drove it, yes. And she's in a place, she's at the pinnacle, that's what I'm saying. And finally, I just want to say that this ending is not the ending of a romantic love story. After all, in a romantic love story, where do they wind up? They wind up in each other's arms in private. Here, they're addressing each other in front of 24,000 students in public, not very romantic.
And really, the ending's not about them, it's about the father. The ending here is the father in Akiva.
You're right, although it seems to me that's an add-on. I think the story really ends with the reveal. And that just goes on to talk about the last thing.
They got what was rightfully theirs.
Yeah. I mean, the father doesn't come off too well in this story. Okay. It's interesting. I mean, it's a story I've heard a lot, but I like the four people in the story that kind of each represented a different view of what a relationship is. I think it comes out very nicely that way. Okay, now we go on to the second story. Now, these two stories are unrelated, but I just happen to connect them to each other, and this is a wilder story, as you'll see, because it has sex in it. it's also a little known, and I did the same thing again, so you have two versions, follow at will, and I have version three with the additions to it, and it comes with a picture. It's the famous reveal. Okay, so this is the story of Choma. Abaye's wife Choma came before Rava. Rava's another scholar, after Abaye died, and Rava was the local judge. She said to him, "Apportion sustenance for me, as I am entitled to be sustained by Abaye's heirs." So Abaye, her husband, has died, and she's now coming to court to sue for what she claims is due to her. And that's usually his money, his goods. But she wants more. Rava apportioned sustenance for her. So she did it. She subsequently says to him, "Apportion wine for me as well." Rava said to her, "I know that Nachmani," who is Abaye's first name, "did not drink wine. Since you were not accustomed to drinking wine in your husband's lifetime, you are not entitled to it after his death." She said to him, "By the master's life, this is not correct. In fact, he would give me wine to drink in cups as large as this." It's an odd Hebrew word, shufreitzi, and it really means like a big horn, like the Vikings had to drink from. She gestured with her hands to show how large the cups were. Okay. While she was showing him the size of the cups, her arm became uncovered, and she was so beautiful that it was though a light had shined in the courtroom. Okay, you got this picture? It's a very physical thing.
There's sort of interpretation in there.
Yes, there is interpretation. Yes.
That's
what I'm saying, and the stories are not exactly the same. Rava arose, went home, and requested intercourse from his wife. Rava got very turned on by this. The daughter of Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda is another famous sage. The daughter of Rav Chisda said to him, "Who is just now in the courtroom?" Noticing his unusual behavior, she suspected there must have been a woman in court. He said to her, "Choma, Abaye's wife, was there." Upon hearing this, Rava's wife went after Choma and struck her with the lock of a chest. It's another phrase, we don't know exactly what it is, kulpe deshita, but that's one of the interpretation. I think somewhere you have straps from a box or whatever. Until she drove her out of the entire city of Mechotza, saying to her, "You have already killed three men," as Abaye was her third husband, "and now you come to kill another one, my husband. Since you showed him your beauty, he will want to marry you." That's the ending of the story. Okay, it's kind of a wild story. Now, let's do a little context here. So, in the same place where the story takes place, again, there's a whole section about women and wine, and I think this is worth looking at and gives you a background to this story. So, on the last page, where it says Babylonian Talmud, Ketubot 65a, you get some of the background here. Wines are not allotted to a wife. The Gemara raises an objection. If the woman is used to drinking wine, she's given wine.
This is as inheritance afterward, after the fact?
No, this is just in general. This is in general. Yes.
I mean, just a statement of fact.
Yeah, and they're talking about women and wine, and you'll see why in a moment. So, the Gemara explains that if a woman is accustomed to wine, it's different. Because Rav Chanina bar Kahana said, Shmuel said, if a woman is accustomed to drinking wine, we give her one cup. If she is not accustomed to drinking wine, we give her two cups. Yes, I'll explain that.
Got to make up for lost time?
I do have an explanation for that.
It better be good.
Well, the Gemara, what's the Gemara's explanation?
I'll have to come across and find it when we get there. All right. Then they go on to qualify this. What does this mean? If she's accustomed to wine, the presence of her husband, she has two cups. If she's not, she gets one cup. And then they reverse it. Now, this is the real killer here. It was taught in a baraita. Remember, baraita is an outside teaching that has the status of a mishnah of the law. I put it in the category of things your mother said to you. One cup of wine is good for a woman. Two cups is a disgrace. After three cups, she's lustful and will request sex. And after four cups, she will request sex from a donkey in the marketplace. At this stage, she is so drunk, she's not particular about whom she sleeps with. Rava said, they taught that a woman should not drink much wine only if her husband is not with her. If her husband is with her, there's no problem. Because presumably, if she gets drunk and then lustful, her husband can satisfy her. So that's why Choma in court requesting wine is such a scandalous thing, because she wants to drink and her husband is dead. So what's going to happen when she gets excited?
But it says one cup is good.
Well, again, but it's in the presence of her husband, not in the presence of her husband. It goes back and forth. I'll get to the next one in a moment. Okay, so back to the story. So once again, here again, there's a tension, I think, between the male and the female world. The male world is the world of order, of logic. The female world is the world of chaos and of emotion, lustfulness, if you will. Choma is derived from the Hebrew word cham, which means
hot.
Hot is chaos, right? Then, as I pointed out, the nature of the lawsuit is not about money, but it's about wine drinking. And that represents a threat to male orderliness of the world. Rava denies her wine. And obviously wine here now is a code word for sexual intercourse. Rava is saying that Abaye, he makes that point about, you know, Abaye didn't drink wine. What he's saying is Abaye controlled himself, and therefore he controlled his wife. But now that he's gone, we, the men, fear that you, Choma, the woman, will not be able to control yourself anymore. But Choma rejects this, right? She says, Rava's assumption about her and her husband is wrong. He's making the assumption that Abaye was this controlled person that didn't engage in relations. But she says two things. A, he did like drinking at home. And they were a party couple, and they had fun, and they drank wine. And she says his cups, his drinking horn, was large, and that means what you think it means. So she's overturning the idea that Rava has about Abaye, about his world. Now, pouring her husband a cup of wine is one of the Talmudic duties of a wife. So that's there. And we also worry about the men, and this, now if you go back to the note, the last one here, in the Tractate of Nedarim, there's a verse that says, do not go about after your own heart, in Numbers. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, that's Rebbe, compiler of the Mishnah, says it is derived from here that a man should not drink from his cup while setting his eyes on another cup. And that also means what you think it means. He shouldn't be with one woman and thinking of another. Now, back to the story again. So, there's a sense from Choma that Abaye and Choma are feasting at their own private banquet. And That's the food image that's put in here, that wine stands for sex. Now, homo with the arm. So there's this is her language, right? She's first responding to the man's sense of orderliness with legal words. But at a certain point, she overturns that, and she responds physically by extending her arm, by using her hands to show the cups. It's again the world of chaos from her. And finally, when she shows her arm, it's like a bomb explodes, right? That's the ultimate physicality of the situation. And these images are threatening to Rava, because Rava is a, what would we say, a button-down guy in his age. And because he's had this explosion of chaos, of femininity, it's not a good word maybe, that's not how his wife behaves. So it gets him excited. Note that Homa has a name. We get her name, but we don't know what Rava's wife's name is. She's referred to as Rav Chisda's daughter. And that's, again, in the masculine world. So now we have a reverse. So now we're at the part where after she showed her arm, Rava gets excited, Rava goes home. We now have a reversal of the situation. We went from the court to the home, and specifically to the bedroom. We go from, we have a case of a strong woman in the first half versus a weak woman in the second half. And actually, Rav Chisda's daughter is now become judge, jury, and executioner. She decides Chom is the one at fault, and she chases after her with a stick. Some say, by the way, a shoe. You know, back to the last week with the shoe things. Because she wants to push her back to where she belongs, to the jungle, to the outskirts of the city. Yeah. Don't break the order.
I'm curious why you classified her though as weak.
Yeah, I don't think anybody who's going after somebody with a stick is weak.
I'm weak because she can't stand up to her husband, in effect. She doesn't go back after her husband, she goes after her rival.
But in the context of the time, that wasn't necessarily weak, that was just the way it was.
Well, but she does go after her husband. He makes a demand, and she says, wait a minute, what's going on here? Who was in court that you all of a sudden you come home so frisky?
I like that.
Okay. Yeah, no, she's...
But that's it. She doesn't... We don't know. She gives in. She doesn't. She yells at him.
Well, it doesn't matter at that point. She does stand up to him.
She stands up. She says, what's going on here? She doesn't give in to him. She says, what gives?
I get what you're saying, and it makes sense, but I think there's a... You know, things that are missing tell a story. The fact that she doesn't respond to him physically or verbally says something. I see that as passiveness.
But the story doesn't tell you.
Clarify what you mean when you say she doesn't respond, because I think we're hearing her respond.
Yes.
Okay.
Don't forget, she initiated the conversation.
Rava went home, demanded that the daughter of Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda's daughter asked him who's been at court. He said, Homa. And now she followed her. So what happened after he told her who was in court?
She got a stick.
She didn't give in to him.
She got a stick and she went after the other woman.
Right. Wait, so that's hardly passive.
Do we know that?
Well, okay. Whether or not they had sex sort of doesn't matter.
Why wouldn't you have expected it to say, you know, Rav Chisda's daughter yelled at him and left the house?
Not necessarily. No.
That would embarrass the Rav.
Well, he doesn't come off looking that good anyway.
He doesn't come off looking that bad. He's in court. Something happens, which is unsettling.
Right.
And he gets up and leaves. Notice he doesn't give in to the temptation from Homa. He goes home.
Right.
Okay. And then he says to his wife, you know,
right,
let's have sex. And she says, no, wait a minute. What's going on here? Because he usually doesn't come home and says, let's have sex.
Or they have sex and then she says, I kind of think that whether or not they actually had sex at that point doesn't matter.
But I agree with you.
She did question where
exactly.
This came from.
If she
also may just be, why is it she knows her husband? So she knows that he's not the source of the problem here.
Yeah.
That going
it's
after him
Wednesday
won't
night.
Solve the problem. that she needs to go after the source.
But Homa never made a play or an advance on Rava at all.
She doesn't know that.
And that's her fear, right? Because it says directly she fears that her husband wants to marry her.
Yeah. I think her arm showing
was making a play.
You think that's an advance?
I think that's their euphemism for making an advance.
Well,
okay.
Maybe it wasn't her arm that was showing.
Or
but regardless,
it was
I don't
among
think
the Orthodox, you got to keep it covered.
Well, yeah, but
everything.
Yeah, but this is not Orthodox. This is 2,000 years earlier.
This is 2,000 years ago. But even then, the women wore a full tunic.
Wore modesty.
The women didn't get out that much. Period.
So the fact that she's drinking all that wine, she's talking and displaying maybe her.
But that only supports the fact that she was hardly passive or weak, because not only, instead of just acquiescing to what her husband wanted, she said, why are you doing this? And then when he answered, regardless of what happened after that, she went out of her house and attacked the woman that she felt was responsible for this.
Okay, I'm withdrawing the weak comment. This is because I fear you're going to unroll your sleeve and come after me with a stick.
Take it easy over here.
Okay.
Showing that upper arm.
So just finishing up points. So first of all, compare the two environments, right? There's the fun Abaye and Homa household where they're making merry and drinking wine and having a good time. And there's the kind of tense and angry Rava household, where it doesn't seem they're getting along all that well. And finally, what about the light that radiates from her? The notes think. It stands for the mystical sexual aspect of women, which has great power. Male culture uses words. Women have this, their own power. Rav Hizda points out that Homa has killed 3 men already with her female powers. But Rava, on the other hand, is in kind of a living death with his wife. Doesn't seem like they're all that compatible. There's an interesting comparison, I think, to the previous story of the living widow. He's kind of like the living widower. Just an idea. Finally, and I do think this is remarkable, now you can look at the picture.
The big reveal.
The reveal. I always like to have a reveal. So this is a painting by Edward Hopper, and I think the author came up with this, and I think it's a remarkable analogy to this story. It's almost like it had come from it, right? This is called Office at Night, and it didn't reproduce all that well, but it seems like now this is all my subjectivity, so feel free to throw more bricks at me, right? It's an office, and it seems like there's the boss, the man sitting at the desk, and it's the secretary, who's attractive, standing up. And he's looking at his papers ostensibly, but at least I get the sense, and maybe it's only because I read the story, you know, he's looking at his paper, but he's trying not to look at her. And you can't see it reproduced very well, but light streaming in from the window, I guess, which is a little odd because it's called Office at Night, so I'm not sure. Although it could be a
street lamp.
And also it's pointed out there's a lot of openings in this story. There's an open window, an open door, an open file cabinet.
An open folder.
And, you know, she has bare arms, and there it seems like the light is kind of sense coming out of her. So, your mileage may vary. I think it really does complement this story very nicely.
But you said the author, like, you didn't randomly find this.
No, this is from the author. He put this in.
He's got this theory too.
Yeah. It's kind of, he says it's kind of like a hint with the light that something is going to burst forth any second in this painting. I think it's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yashikawa.
Kind of like she's trying to seduce him.